The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
On 92.7 and 106 FM.
Good evening. Welcome to The Money Show. It is brought to you by APSA Corporate and Investment Banking. Proud to collaborate with the SA Tomorrow Conference. That's Africanacity. APSA is a registered FSP. This is The Money Show. I am Bruce Whitfield. And the Reserve Bank Governor, Lesetša Ganyago, will join us in just a little bit as we talk about the state of the global economy and the state of the world as we know it. That is what is top of our agenda this evening as we do The Money Show tonight. And as I tell you also what is coming up on the agenda tonight as we look at the wage settlement that Sibanye has agreed upon. Sibanye, of course, has agreed upon a wage settlement for its gold mining workers, and now also for its platinum workers are now going to come under the cosh as well. So we're looking forward to looking at that. And also tonight we have got Make Money Mondays, because I like to do little throwbacks, other people's money. That's what we call it now. It's also good to have the Reserve Bank Governor on this evening. He's taking a break from signing the country's banknotes to talk to us about some serious issues that are building in the global economy and are also building in our economy as a result. Meantime, just three stories to help set the scene. Thungela Resources says that coal production for export will be down 14% on the first half of 2022 because of Transnet's rail problems. They're having to curtail production. It's pushing up their costs. Costs, of course, massively, something like 44%. It's absolutely huge. And of course, in the environment where global demand is so high for coal, prices of some grades have tripled, and we're missing out hugely on that. And then a report today from economics and energy advisory firm called Meridian Economics that if the Renewable Energy Independent Power Producer Program, the REAP, had not stalled in 2016, load shedding may have been reduced by 96.5%. It would also have saved Eskom 2.5 billion rand. Meridian saying that these 5 gigawatts of additional renewable generation capacity would have been procured through 2 bidding rounds. So a shambles there. And then, related to that, I suppose, Val d'Avis, that estate near Paarl where houses can get a flat for 2 million if you just want an entry-level little place to rest your head, or you can buy a 5-bedroom house for 20 million. But they are putting in a massive solar plant, 3,600 photovoltaic modules. This is the new world in which we live, where state failure leads to private sector innovation and intervention. So just a couple of things to tee up the Reserve Bank Governor this evening. That Reserve Bank Governor is none other than Lesetša Ganyago, who is on the line to us from Pretoria tonight, from no doubt the Reserve Bank. And Governor, welcome to The Money Show. Good to have you with us. One of the big issues that really affecting absolutely everything right now is American inflation. And it came in on Friday at 8.6%. It was expected to be at 8.3%. The world was hoping we would see a tapering in inflation, but there's no end in sight to it. And it's causing all kinds of problems for the world today. What's your take on American inflation right now?
Good evening. What we have heard is that as the global economy reopens, supply is struggling to cope with the demand. And what we have then seen had been that prices globally began to rise as there are constraints in the supply chain globally. Mm-hmm. And that made central banks to have make an assessment and say, is this a temporary phenomenon or is it going to be with us for a longer period of time? The initial take, we thought that supply will adequately respond to the demand, seems to be losing traction. And as a result, inflation keeps on surprising us on the upside. So globally, central banks had responded in 2020 by widening stimulus, and some of the treasuries that had the space to do so also responded with a stimulus. So that was the combination of those and a failure of supply to respond meant that prices were thus going up. What does the inflation in the advanced economies mean for South Africa? Two channels. The first one is that there are real price effects here, in the sense that to the extent that prices of goods in the advanced economies are rising, South Africa procuring goods from those advanced economies is going to procure them at a higher price. Secondly, is that central banks in the advanced economies thus, in responding to inflation, are tightening monetary policy. And as they tighten monetary policy, it changes the relative prices in financial assets. Financial assets reprice. And as financial assets reprice, capital starts to move to where the returns are more attractive. And so you would find that there has been a movement of capital, and emerging markets are facing tighter financing conditions. And South Africa, as a small open economy, that is what we would thus face. This tightening of financial conditions and the realignment of asset prices means that it is not just the shares and the bonds that reprice, foreign exchange rates also get realigned. And we have seen that although the rate has not weakened as much as in many other currencies, the effect of combination of a depreciating currency and rising prices in the advanced economies mean that that inflation catches up with us. We're fortunate in South Africa because we started responding in November last year and made sure that we are taking measured steps that we are dealing with inflation whilst at the same time continuing to provide support to the South Africa.
On that point, Governor, and this is an important point to make, there's lots of talk that in the United States that the next move there is to try and head off inflation, is to raise rates by 75 basis points, which is something they haven't done since 2004 and something they hadn't done since 1994. So that is a big issue because suddenly you start getting these interest rate shocks coming through the system. When you look at our environment in South Africa, we were hoping to keep inflation tame with 25 basis point increases. You took a decision as a Monetary Policy Committee at the last meeting to raise by 50 basis points. Is that the norm for the rest of this year at each MPC meeting to see 50 basis point increases? What is your reading of the tea leaves at this stage? I realize we can't hold you to it, but what is your sense of it?
Well, 50 basis points would not be off the table, but neither is 25 basis points off the table. We have got to, going into every MPC meeting, assess the state of the South African economy, look for inflation, taking cognizance of all of these global forces and domestically what we are seeing, and the thing to watch domestically is whether the domestic price setters, being business and labor, whether they are readjusting their prices higher because there is the perception that inflation is rising. That just means that the expectations of the price setters is for inflation to go higher. That is when monetary policy comes in, because we have got to demonstrate that as a central bank, we are prepared to protect the buying power of the wages and salaries of the working people. We must be able to protect the income of those who are on social grants, on fixed income, by ensuring that inflation is kept within check. Because failure to do so would result in a situation where the buying power of South African working people are eroded. And this is a point we have been making over and over again, that rising inflation is an enemy of working people, that it erodes the buying power of their earnings.
But the immediate emotional response, and this is why it's so important to understand this point, the immediate emotional response of most people when interest rates go up say, hold on a second, why is the Reserve Bank punishing us? We're paying $24 a litre for fuel. We're already having money sucked out of our pockets in higher and higher taxes. We're getting fleeced on every corner, and now the Reserve Bank is making it worse. This argument of charging higher interest rates to slow down inflation in an economy that is not demand-driven, this is all outside pricing pressure that is coming through and driving our inflation rate. There's very little demand in our economy. Please explain why inflation is an important tool under these conditions. I mean, interest rates are an important tool under these conditions.
Well, it is the instrument that central banks have that intermediate between savers and borrowers. And for me, for us here, is that inflation, whether it is coming from a supply side or it's coming from a demand side, it is still a problem. What we do is that if inflation comes as a result of supply shock, we then say, let us see whether there is any evidence that inflation is spreading wider in the economy, and that is what we respond to. So we do not respond to the initial supply shock. The problem we are having at the moment is that you have got a multiplicity of supply shocks. You have got constraints in the global supply chain. You have got rising energy prices. You have got rising food prices. A combination of those means that those prices might be spreading to the other areas which were not directly affected by the shock. And to the extent that those prices spread to the other areas which were not initially affected by the shock, we say that there is evidence of second round effect. And that is what a central bank has to respond to. It is very, very important to understand that inflation erodes the buying power of incomes. Bruce, I mean, if you are on a salary, you can negotiate an increase once a year with your employer. If inflation comes out to be a bit higher than what you have negotiated an increase for, your buying power is getting eroded. And that is why the central bank has got to act to protect that buying power. The thing about inflation, especially as we are seeing it now, is that whether you are employed or unemployed, it is going to affect you.
Yeah.
The tragedy of the situation is that those with financial assets can protect themselves against the ravages of inflation, but ordinary working people cannot, and hence a monetary authority in the form of the central bank that must act to control inflation.
A year ago in Stellenbosch, you were talking about having an inflation target of 2 to 4%. You said we'd missed many opportunities in the past of reducing the inflation target range from 3 to 6%, where it sat for 20 years, and we should really be thinking about 2 to 4%. Is that still on the table, do you think?
Well, the time to actually talk of having an inflation target is exactly when inflation is rising, because then people understand why high inflation is not good for them. The talk of a 2 to 4% inflation target is nothing new. That is what Tito Mboweni and Trevor Mannion had agreed to in 2002, but correctly decided, or rather, let me say, at the time, it looked correct not to go to a lower target and instead reinstated the target, which was initially 3 to 5, back to 3 to 6. If you were to ask me what was the biggest macroeconomic mistake that we had made on the monetary front, it was exactly that. The correct thing to have done then was to say, yes, we have experienced a supply shock. Inflation will fall outside of our target, but we expect the central bank will bring it back within the target. And now, even in this environment, as inflation is rising globally, everybody, the developed world, they are not talking about revising their inflation target higher. They are instead getting to communicate that they are going to bring inflation lower. And in the case of the developed world, their targets are inflation of 2%, which for us, even if we were to talk about 2 to 4%, we will still be higher than the higher than the developed world.
Would you, so, is this a serious discussion as we sit here right now? Evaluating and revisiting the inflation target range. Do we wait for this storm to pass, or do we knuckle down and try to get this inflation target moved?
Well, the Minister of Treasury had been busy with a macroeconomic review. One of the papers that had been released is a paper authored by the former governor of Ireland and the former governor of Cyprus. And it is interesting reading. And that paper after going through an international comparison and South Africa's, the evolution of South Africa's inflation since we have introduced inflation targeting, came to the conclusion that the correct thing for South Africa to do is to target lower inflation. Put it simply, Bruce, if we entered the crisis with inflation that was higher than the 4.5% that the Reserve Bank was aiming for in 2020, we wouldn't have been able to provide the kind of support to the economy that we were able to provide in the aftermath of the coronavirus shock. So there is no virtue in higher inflation.
So in a word, you would support a lower inflation target, even in these uncertain times of 2-4%. If the National Treasury said to you, there's your new target, you'd say, good, excellent, thank you very much.
It's a conversation that the Treasury and us would have. The point here is, it's important to demonstrate to South Africans that the South African authorities are committed to protect the buying power of their income by keeping inflation in check. Tolerating higher inflation is not going to lead to higher income. Higher inflation introduces uncertainty and erodes income. And you say in these uncertain times, well, by sticking to our inflation target, we are actually providing certainty to the price setters. And by engaging in conversation that, yes, we have got this inflation target, we could be aiming lower, provide a certainty to the price setter. At the moment, the inflation targeting range is 3-6. There is nothing that stops the Reserve Bank from aiming to a target that is closer to 3% within this 3-6% range. There is nothing that stops us because it is a range. We can work within the range. What is important is for us to demonstrate to South Africans that we mean business when we say that we would control inflation.
Governor Lesetja Ganyago, thank you very much indeed. On the line to us from Pretoria, thank you very much indeed. Yeah, so inflation targeting, very much the key message of that. We have had Matete Tulare from RMB hanging all the way through that. I'll ask for Matete's indulgence and say, Matete, can we talk in about 10 minutes, please? Because we need to understand what this means, all of what the Reserve Bank Governor has been talking about this evening, what it means for your buying power, what it means for the value of the currency, because that in itself is inflationary risk as well. If the currency blows out, of course, imported inflation goes through the roof and we import far too much. So we'll chat to Matete about that in just a bit.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
Also listening in on that part of the conversation, Peter Brook, Portfolio Manager at the Old Mutual Investment Group. And, that sort of certainty that the Reserve Bank Governor is pushing for is kind of hard to see in the daily maelstrom of market panic and volatility, Peter Brook. And of that, there has been plenty today.
That is true. The Aussie took a good day to have a holiday. we've actually, if you look at it, you've had three very sharp down days in the US, basically since that high inflation number came out. And that's sort of basically contagion around the world with all markets down sharply and South Africa just following in line with it.
How grey are you going? I mean, you're a fit young man, relatively speaking. Are you taking strain in this current sell-off? Or are you sort of riding it like the Bronco rider that you've become over many years of market fluctuations?
I was actually rather enjoying it for the first sort of period because a lot of the things that were selling off were things that we thought were extremely expensive and we didn't own any of. So US bonds, Bitcoin, growth shares in America. But as it sort of got worse, it's starting to take down shares that we do think have value and we do think there's opportunities in. So obviously that starts to weigh on you, but that also creates opportunity because you can look to buy into some of those good assets that get priced down.
I mean, Sydney's market is feeling all fall downish, and I think it's far from all fall downish. It's just a question of how aggressive central banks have to become in order to bring the inflation monster under control. And the question is whether or not that pushes the US into recession. And I don't know if that's that much of a big deal. I know Americans panic about recession, but it's part of a natural cycle that we've kind of fallen out of in the last decade and a half. And I wonder if we're not due just a bit of a cool off.
I think that's probably correct. And the interesting thing is, a lot of the recessions that we have had have been huge events. Think of the global financial crisis. In the old days, we used to have slightly more frequent recessions and slightly smaller. So they do have a big impact because obviously they're not profits. But they also, in a way, the truth is that the world is overheating. You can see that through the level of inflation. And therefore, we need a little bit of a reset. And sort of a short, sharp recession, while definitely unpleasant, if you take sort of the old English adage, like a bracing swim, it does create opportunity from those moves.
It most certainly, it most certainly does, but we're seeing wild fluctuations and the currency also wreaking havoc. And Lesitja Khanyako now just talking about the currency and, of course, the importance of keeping interest rates competitive worldwide so that even though we're not seeing demand-driven inflationary pressures in South Africa, at least what we are seeing is an attempt to keep inflation under control, an element to predictability. And I was just looking at a table today of inflation rates around the world and just how close South Africa would have come to these sorts of catastrophic numbers of Argentina at 51%, Venezuela at 500%, Turkey at 60%, Zimbabwe at 87%, and other countries in the 60s and 70% of inflation, with expectations from the IMF of South Africa sort of sitting between 5 and 10%, along with much of the rest of the world, and, you know, Russian inflation spiking up as well. And I just look at this and think how different things could have been without a firm policy stance being taken first by National Treasury and then implemented by the Reserve Bank.
I completely agree with you. So, I mean, let's take today's move. The Rand moved out to just over 16, or 1.5% weaker. But the truth is, I mean, the Japanese yen has weakened by 22% in the last 12 months. We actually are being extremely well behaved. If you look from 2018 across it, kind of at these levels, other than the blowout for COVID. And a lot of that is due to the fact that our inflation differentials have narrowed relative to the rest of the world. And a lot of it is actually due to having a hawk like Lesitja Khanyako at the tiller, and he's done a good job. And our macroprudential policy over time has been consistent. But also, I think the fact that we were heading into the abyss and we pulled back and we're having more sensible policy has definitely stood us in good stead on a relative competitive basis to the rest of the world, because everyone's got problems. And it's just who's got the least smelly shirt. And in this environment, South Africa's not looking that bad.
Thank you, Peter Brook. He's a portfolio manager at the Old Mutual Investment Group. On the line to us this evening from soggy Cape Town.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. Proud to collaborate with the SA Tomorrow Conference. That's Africanacity. Absa's a registered FSP.
This is The Money Show. I'm Bruce Whitfield. Matete Tulare joining us in just a moment, the head of foreign exchange execution at Rand Merchant Bank. I wonder what the Reserve Bank's comments, the Reserve Bank governor's comments this evening about inflation targeting, the need to keep raising interest rates, 50 basis points not off the table, nor is 25 basis points. But the fact that 50 basis points is not off the table is significant, because it wasn't a one-hit wonder, this last interest rate increase, and so money becomes a lot more expensive. Why? Because we've got to control inflation. Inflation is going to corrode the value of your money far more quickly than absolutely anything else on this planet. And that is the concern. Let's have a little chat to Matete Tulare this evening. Matete, thank you for coming back to us tonight. Head of Foreign Exchange Execution at RMB. You listen to every word the Reserve Bank governor said. Are you calmer or more concerned after listening to that conversation?
Good evening, Bruce. I suppose, look, it's really going to be quite an interesting one because, I mean, if you think about it, more than 60 global central banks have already raised their rates this year. And obviously, every central bank at this point in time is trying to tackle the ever-persistent inflation that is obviously squeezing households. And it is prompting large-scale government support, obviously on the back of the geopolitical tension out in Europe that has driven the energy costs higher. So, you know, even if you just look at what's happening this week, you know, the policy decision from the Fed obviously is going to take center stage. And I suppose also, you know, also the ECB, where there's about 17 speeches that are going to be made by ECB policymakers. And this is after a week where we've seen the ECB raise their interest rates for the first time in close to a decade. Now, obviously, all these speeches are going to be concentrated on Wednesday and Thursday. And I think from the ECB perspective, it's going to really give us more clarity on their policy decision-making and how aligned policymakers are in terms of their thinking. But then obviously, you know, when you look back at Lesetša and what he's saying, I mean, prior to this 50 basis point hike that we saw last month at the previous meeting, you know, two of the MPC members had wanted a 50 basis point hike and the other three had requested a 25 basis point hike. And obviously we started with the 25 basis point increase at the beginning of the year. And then the second meeting of the year, that's when we saw the 50 basis point hike. And I think the next meeting, obviously next month, will really be driven around what happens in terms from global sentiment and obviously developments that are happening from a global perspective and what also the Fed decides to do. You know, it's just a lot of moving parts, unfortunately, for Lesetša and friends out in Pretoria for them to mull over.
So, I mean, give me an outlook then on the currency based on what we're seeing. We've seen a massive sell-off in, well, not really. Is it a sell-off in the rand or is it a buy-up of the dollar, I wonder? But the dollar very, very strong today, 4% better off against the rand today. And I wonder if it's an knee-jerk reaction to the inflation number on Friday, if things settle down and calm down again. Or are we in a new phase of the currency at this stage? I can't see it because of the inflation rate differential between us and the United States, but your view?
Look, I mean, you know, if anything, yes, inflation fallout from Friday has continued into today. I suppose, you know, so much for U.S. inflation having peaked, you know, which has, you know, this has obviously spurred both that there could be more aggressive Fed rate hikes, which obviously now is hitting the currency. I mean, already the 8.6 inflation number, that is much higher than the March number of 8.5. So it really does show that the U.S. has that. Have a serious inflation problem. But also, does this mean maybe the Fed may be forcing us into recession? As you said earlier, the markets are pricing 50 basis points hike this week and also another 75 in July. Already, you know, some of the market surveys and talk is potentially about a 70% chance of a U.S. recession next year. And that obviously has hit equity markets. But I suppose also, you know, if you combine that with the renewed COVID testing that is happening in China, that's also adding to the misery. Locally, also, just don't forget that there's also rumblings in the background that obviously, from a political perspective, that's also fueling, you know, this whole fire. So it's obviously this perfect cocktail now where we've got the rand at its highest level since May 19th. And I suppose if you just think about it, high inflation across the globe, the slowing global growth, and the continued geopolitical tension are obviously all negative for emerging markets, including the rand. So I think that's why at this point in time, you know, it is key for us if we can hold below the 1635, which is 2022's high, then I don't see us going any further. But obviously, if the situation does deteriorate, then it could potentially mean that we could be back up at 17.
Okay. Thank you. It's a big target and it moves. The head of foreign exchange execution at RMB, that's Matete Tulare this evening. Yeah, the currency is notoriously unpredictable. Yes, inflation's notoriously unpredictable too. What becomes slightly more predictable if it's properly managed is the public policy response to inflation, which is higher interest rates. The Reserve Bank governors laid it out quite clearly for us this evening. 50 basis points at the next MPC, not off the table, nor is 25 basis points. I suspect they'll go for 50, depending, of course, on what other central banks are doing. Certainly, the trend is tighter. But Okay, before you start getting cross and shouting at your radio or streaming Netflix while you're driving, which is never a good thing, by the way, don't ever do that, especially if you're in Cape Town and it's raining this evening, doubly no. It's a question of understanding what happens when politicians and idiots get involved in monetary policy, as we had so close in South Africa, 2016, 2017, that era of intervention in the world of professionals. And you look at Turkey with inflation sitting at 70% or thereabouts. We could so easily have gone there.
You're with Bruce Whitfield
on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
I mentioned this new report today, and it is from Meridian Economics. They are specialists in economics and energy advisory, and they're claiming that we could have seen 96.5% less load shedding in 2021 had the REAP program, the Renewable Energy Independent Power Producer program, not stalled in 2016. Well, it's pointless crying over spilt milk. The program did certainly become dislocated. Now, it's encouraging to see the African Rainbow Energy and Power Chief Executive talking about a huge boost or plans for a big boost in clean energy. I caught up with Brian Damas in Davos just a couple of weeks ago. This is a new development for African Rainbow Energy's Chief Executive, Brian Damas. The big plans that you've got here, Brian, as we sit in a power crisis, we haven't had load shedding for 2 weeks. I'm beginning to think it's a holiday. But we're incredibly vulnerable, as we all know, to load shedding. Your goal in terms of getting renewable energy investment over the next couple of years, what are your plans?
Evening, Bruce, and welcome back to South Africa. As we shared, over the next few months, we have over 2,000 megawatts of projects with our partners that we'll be closing.
Yep.
And our long-term plans is that you need to build an energy company with scale. And for us, you know, if we over the medium term get to 5,000 megawatts invested, you know, that will be a useful size, and it's very important that one does that to provide reliable energy, affordable, and really start turning the dial.
I mean, 5,000 megawatts in English is, if a power station, a South Africa power station, was working, it'd be the equivalent of one of the big power stations that we've got, right, if it was working at full capacity.
Yeah, absolutely, but there's a difference between energy or capacity, megawatts, and energy, which is megawatt hours. The wind blows on average over a year 30 to 40% of the time, and sun shines between 16 and 20% of the time. So, you know, one of the large power stations work for the full day. So there's a distinct difference between that, and so one has to make sure that your energy solutions are well sculpted for what the demand is in the country. But the quickest energy we can all put on the table, the cleanest energy, the one that's most affordable, is certainly renewables.
And not wanting to cry over spilt milk, but I mean, the report today, and I'm sure you've seen it from the guys at Meridian, they were saying we could have missed out on 96% of last year's load shedding had the REAP not stalled. And it just goes to the importance of these programs getting started and then being seen through and getting lots of players building lots of capacity at the same time, including people as such as yourselves.
I haven't seen the report. I saw the newspaper articles. I think it's very important, not just for our country, for all the countries on the continent. Policy certainty is very important. Secondly, policy consistency in application of policy. You know, energy projects, whether it is energy in the sense of generation, transmission, or distribution, takes time to plan, to invest. And all of us need to work together, the private sector as well as, government. And so that consistency in policy is very good that we're currently experiencing. And that's true for us, and it's true for any other country around the world. That attracts investors, that gives confidence in the regulatory environment and the rules of the game, and attracts capital.
Talk to me about the efficacy of the Department of Energy. It doesn't get a great rap at the best of times. What is your sense of the level of skill, the level of application, and the level of thinking within the Department of Energy right now in terms of creating longer-term solutions for us?
I mean, we have seen, we have an integrated resource plan. I mean, our teams, we invested in an excellent company in Cape Town, the Solar Group, and they have been the absolute front runners around the wheeling of power in South Africa. They've done the first project, wheeling in South Africa. We've just got the regulatory approval for two pumps, you know, 100 megawatt solar projects that the team has worked through all the departmental processes. So, you know, we have seen all of that being delivered. So we do certainly have seen that policy commitments being turned into, you know, actual executable projects. And round six has been launched. So a lot of excitement around that. And the department is clear around the closing of the round five projects over the next, you know, few months.
Thank you to Brian Damas, the Chief Executive at African Rainbow Energy. Our 2,000 megawatts will be in play by the end of this year for private customers. They'll go to a scale at this stage of about 5,000 megawatts. That's the plan. The more that we can get of the sort of scale of African Rainbow Capital and what they're planning and what they will roll out and what they will develop is critical. Sooner, the better. In a moment, funky new projectors that can fit into your backpack. Not the stuff that used to hang in your classroom at school or from the office boardroom ceiling that weigh about 30 kilograms and threaten to pull the roof down. Fabulous new tech. Noticed quite a lot of it in Dubai recently. I'll pick up on that with Toby Shapshak at Stuff Studios in a moment.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
On to tech with Toby this evening. And when I came through Dubai recently, I noticed a new explosion in a particular new category of device, and that is projectors. And they've been around a long time, but they've become a lot smaller. They've become a lot smarter. They've become a lot niftier than ever. And it would seem that the days of the massive ones that hang ominously from ceilings in the boardrooms are a thing of the past. Toby Shapshak, Chief at Stuff Studios. These are cool little projectors that you can you stream from your phone to them? Do you have to plug your phone into them? How do they work?
You can, but you can actually, it's actually a smart projector, Bruce. Let's call it that. It's the Samsung Freestyle projector. It's really fascinating because you install Netflix and Showmax and Amazon Prime and whatever other services you use directly into the decoder
on
as
it.
You would with a television. If you've on the actual decoder. So I'm logged into Netflix. I had a very strange kind of problem I couldn't overcome, Bruce, which is that I have too much art on the walls. So what did I do? I lay on the couch with a pillow under my head with my son, and we watched on the roof. I mean, we could have probably read a blog as well, but we just watched Netflix, and it was really fantastic. Netflix and Showmax, I should say. So it was like a really quirky way to test what is a really impressive projector. I took it to Stuff Studios in Bromfontein, and I increased the size on, you know, with this massive white wall that runs down the side of our studio, and watched a bit of movies on that. You know, it's really fantastic. It's kind of a rethinking, Bruce, in many ways of what we use projectors and television for. Projectors for a long time were something that you could only get if you were very, very wealthy. No longer. Something like this Freestyle, it's very, very clever, very elegant. It's got a very smart interface, works with Samsung's SmartThings interface. So you can have the app on your phone, the app finds the device when you turn it on, you log it in, or there's a QR code on the wall, which I scanned, and it's very simple to set up, very simple to use, but easy to use, I should say, not simple to use. yes. And what's fascinating for me is that there's kind of a rethink going on for what you would use a television or a projector in which room and what you do it. You know, in a family home, you'd have a TV in the TV room, but maybe you'll have a spare TV for the kids that'll be a gaming monitor that's specifically orientated to gaming, faster refresh rate, amongst other things, you know, and perhaps you would have a projector in another room. You can watch both smart apps as you would a TV.
If one was a cheapskate, you
can do a bunch of other things. You can play music.
If one hypothetically was a cheapskate and one's TV broke, and then could one replace one's TV with one of these projectors? Because if you're only streaming content, you don't need a TV anymore.
Totally. No, I mean, this is a 14,000 Rand device, right? And it's a very good price for what it is. I've been playing with a lot of these portable projectors, and Bruce, and you would have seen them As you said, in Dubai, you're such a trendsetter, such a jet setter.
That's me.
There's some very interesting concept devices coming along. A lot of them have a built-in battery. They have a really good speaker. You know, same with the Freestyle. Very good sound quality for what you get with it. You can plug an HDMI cable into it if you want to. You know, you can stream directly from a phone to this device, or you can log into the apps directly. I think the usability, I mean, my use case was a bit of an extreme example because I'm sorry that I love art, but, you know, I could have probably done it in one of the bedrooms where there's a, you know, an empty wall. But it was a great use case because I want to have like a movie night at the studio. Don't worry, you'll be invited. And it's a really great, huge space. It's like 350 square meters.
So now if you've got one of these little
and the
projectors,
wall is massive, so you can project onto the whole wall. It's like going to the drive-in.
Okay, so you can get really good resolution and get a decent-sized screen. You're not looking at sort of like a – because I watched a video and it said you can get a 100-inch screen, which is, for most homes, frankly.
Yes, it's
a phenomenal size. You project it onto a wall. It doesn't need to be a white wall. It's got really adjustable color tones.
That's the fascinating thing, Bruce.
And it's also very light.
If you project it onto a wall that isn't white, that has got a shade or it's got a color, it very cleverly compensates for that. So I tested that because we have like a gray color on our wall. I think it's called bleached lichen. Yes, that's its name. It's bleached lichen. And I tested that to see what the color variation would be. And I thought it was really good. It was a very good representation in spite of the wall, as you say, not being, you know, pearly white.
No, but this is the big innovation. I mean, so these things are much smaller. They're much lighter. This one weighs about 750 grams. I can either stream or plug it to my phone, or I can simply upload the applications of the services I use directly onto this particular, it's the Samsung Freestyle projector. And it's got a speaker in it. Now, do I need a sound bar? Because for televisions, you always recommend having a sound bar. Is the speaker that's built into this device sufficient to keep me happy, or do I need lots of other bits and pieces to add onto it, which then take the price up?
Sure, it kept me happy, Bruce. I mean, I'm not as skillful a tech reviewer as you are, and not as quite as an audiophile as you, but I think it was pretty good. There's a nice offer running actually at the moment, pre-order on Samsung.com or Hersh's, and you can get a carry case, skins, a 3,000 Rand voucher, and 3 months of free Netflix. So I think the sound quality is pretty good. Okay. There's a nice deal there. I sent you the YouTube link. It's really fantastic. 750 grand. That's less than my laptop, Bruce.
No, it's amazing.
And probably a lot more fun.
And I don't know. You're not Mr. Athletics, are you? But in the olden days, you get those red, those infrared lamps that you would, if you pulled a muscle and you would sit in front of the infrared lamp and it would target you. The mechanism's a bit like that. So it's a speaker that's on a hinge so that you can aim it at a wall. Yes. And then you can, as you did, flip it up the ceiling. I'd be asleep in 30 seconds. I mean, it's hard enough to stay awake on the couch. But yes.
Listen, I'm a non-practicing health fanatic, so I never used one of those red infrared lamps. But my late father used to have one, so I do know what you're talking about. Fantastic way to watch television on the roof. I like to cover all bases for you, Bruce.
Thank you, Toby, and I'm grateful. Thank you. If you are bedridden, this is a great solution for you, but also mobile and really quite flexible. Toby Shapshak, Chief at Stuff Studios.
You're with Bruce Whitfield
on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
Wage settlements are always so confounding. I wonder if just the people who construct the blooming things really understand them and then perhaps convey what they really mean on the one side to shareholders of companies who pay higher wages and on the other side to the people who will be receiving those wages. But I wonder how much of it tied up in obfuscation and loads of nonsense, frankly, because the settlements are always really, really complicated to try and decipher. Certainly what it looks like from the Sibanye-Stillwater perspective on its gold mining operations is that Sibanye-Stillwater is paying a lot more than it intended to settle a long-running wage dispute with its gold mining workers. And then this will have an impact on Sibanye's platinum operations. More on that in a moment. We've also then this evening got our book review, and that is with Bronwyn And Bronwyn Williams, the trend translator and future finance specialist at Flux Trends. The book is The Rationalist's Guide to the Galaxy by Tim Chivers. It promises to be a good one. And then we'll talk about other people's money, specifically with Mkhubisi and Tletjana this evening. Just about one particular guy's money, just reflect on it, because Mkhubisi is a political analyst, and what happens when you find, oh, look, surprise, money under the mattress. Is it? Don't you love it? When you are putting on a jacket you haven't worn since last winter, and there's money in the pocket, and you go, hey, look at that. The president had that the other day. It was like, great. Sat on the sofa and like, oh, you know, you find something behind the cushion, like a chip from last night's supper or something. He found dollars. It was awesome. And he's in a bunch of trouble for it. So on the more serious note, we'll reflect on that a little bit, and then also talk to Mkhubisi as an academic about money and his approach to money and all things related.
You're with Bruce Whitfield
on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
I don't know if you remember a couple of months ago, probably what, 6 weeks ago, 8 weeks ago? I'm looking for an indication. Yeah, my producers are nodding. Yeah, but 6, 8 weeks ago. In the earlier stages of this Sibanye-Stillwater strike at its gold mines in South Africa, we had the chief executive, Neil Froneman, on the radio. We talked to him about why he wouldn't settle, why in quite a high inflationary environment he was sticking to his guns and not capitulating to pressure from trade unions. And what he said got a lot of people quite cross. Just to remind you, this is Neil Froneman, 6, 8 weeks ago.
We can afford higher wage demands, but it's completely inappropriate. And I want to reference your introduction this evening to the inflationary environment that we are finding ourselves in. And part of the inflationary environment is caused by increases that are taking place that are above inflation. So a fair increase is related to inflation, and we've adjusted our offer in line with inflation. And we're not going to budge from that. It's not about affordability. It's not about a profitability. It's about being responsible in the longer term. And that same confusion is going to permeate the platinum wage negotiations. And it's one of the reasons that I referenced that the PGM Indaba Day, that we're heading into a global recession because of these inflationary pressures. And as you said, it's not about getting your knickers in a knot. It's actually about planning and doing the right things.
Neil Froneman, chief executive of Sibanye-Stillwater. Listening to that is journalist at Business Maverick, Ed Stoddart. And interesting comments as he started off there, saying we can afford to pay more, but it would be inappropriate. Your reading of the settlement and these things, as I said earlier, Ed, are quite complicated. But has Sibanye-Stillwater had to pay a lot more than it had hoped to do 2, 3, 4 months ago?
Yeah. Hi, Bruce, and good evening. No, I suppose they certainly have paid more than they originally intended to do. It's not a massive amount. If I recall, at one stage they were offering 700 Rand a month as an increase in each year, and now they've settled for effectively 1,900, and I think the third year 750. So I mean, they are paying more, but you know, as Neil kind of hinted, they can actually probably afford it. I think, of course, that all eyes will now be on the platinum wage talks, and in the PGM sector, I think the point is that Sibanye can't plead poverty. So with the gold, like so in gold, for example, the line has been that the operations are fairly marginal, that they're not making nearly the same kind of profits that the PGM operations are, and that the company doesn't cross subsidize. But now there will be no talk of cross subsidizing because the wage talks are going to be taking place at its operations that, you know, have been making very, very good money.
They most certainly have, yet all of these things are cyclical, and what any employer, certainly in the mining sector, which is notoriously cyclical, is reluctant to do is blow out the wage bill this year because there's been such a spectacular performance this year, and then get into a lower price cycle and then be stuck with a high wage bill, and that then just leads to big cutbacks and big changes in strategy. So how are they likely to have to manage it this time?
Well, I think the Anglo-American Platinum wage agreement is going to be the template, and that's a five-year agreement, and it's basically over 7% per year, which is still over, you know, the CPI rate in South Africa currently is 5.9%. It is expected to accelerate in coming months because of food and fuel prices. But I think that'll serve the template in kind of the way that the Harmony Gold Agreement that five unions signed up to in September last year without resorting to downing tools, that kind of set the template for NUM and AMCU in these negotiations. So I think the AMPLATS the settlement will be something that broadly, even if the first demands are like, you know, the AMCU demands initially were almost 40%. We've discussed this before on your show. But they will come back down to earth, but it'll be in Platt's range is my guess.
Okay. So when we're up, I mean, certainly they can afford it. And the CEO himself got himself a big fat pay settlement this last year as well. So that becomes harder and harder to ignore also as the big issue, I suppose, the elephant in the room when it comes to negotiating workers' salaries. When we look at the strategies of our platinum producers and the huge demand that we're seeing for platinum as an industrial metal, as the world tries to wean itself of fossil fuels, and platinum group metals in so many ways are very useful in this transition, I wonder what the outlook is on prices and just how confident the companies are, whether there are any big expansion plans in the wings on these, Ed?
Well, I don't see any big expansion plans at the moment. Having said that, a couple of analysts I've spoken to seem to think that the outlook for PGMs for prices are quite robust at the moment. There's a number of things, not least concerns about Russian supplies at the moment. And Russia is the world's number one producer of palladium, for example. South Africa is tops across the rest of the PGM board. So there's lots of things keeping the price elevated, including, ironically, both the drive to green energy, but at the same time, the fact that some people still feel that the internal combustion engine is going to be around longer than some people expect, which is also obviously, you know, supportive of PGM prices.
Yeah, and if you look at the sort of the scale of demand for the metals, the battery minerals, if you like, that is going to happen in the next 10, 15 years. I was just, you know, sitting on a session in Davos, and just everyone's ambition is huge in terms of excavating battery minerals and converting them into batteries and all sorts of things, and really revolutionizing the way in which the world stores and consumes energy into the future, which is brilliant. But if everybody does it all at once, my goodness gracious me, I don't know how we're going to cope. And that's why, you know, there's quite a lot of confidence in this cycle being extended, you know, if not in perpetuity, certainly for the next decade or so.
Well, yeah, certainly. It certainly seems to have legs, we could say that. Look, another point about the PGM talks is that they're going to come against the background of the forthcoming 10th anniversary of the Marikana massacre. And so AMCU is, for one, is certainly going to want to drive a hard bargain with that in the background, especially because the Marikana operation is now owned by Sibanye.
Yeah, and this is, I mean, the world is changing, isn't it? In weird and wonderful ways. Thank you, Ed Stoddard, journalist at Business Maverick. Ed Stoddard this evening on The Money Show.
The Money Show.
Business Books.
to Bronwyn Williams, the trend translator, the future finance specialist at Flux Trends this evening. Our book, The Rationalist's Guide to the Galaxy. I'm terrified of this one, as I of most of the books that Bronwyn Williams reads, because they are mind-bending in the extreme. Bend our minds with this one, if you would, Bronwyn.
Yeah, sure. So this one was written by Tom Shivers. He kind of went almost undercover into the rationalist community, which is based out of basically San Francisco side of the US. And it's quite a strange movement. It's like some people would see it as almost being kind of borderline cultish, but it's supposed to be anything but that. The rationalist movement is supposed to be exactly as the name specifies, rational, right? So looking at things objectively rather than subjectively. And they've interrogated everything from morality and sexual norms. I think that the more sort of scandalous side of this community is where they're best known for embracing things like polyamory, for example, and, you know, all sorts of alternative ways of living, because they're not bound by sort of the rest of us as sort of norm codes that, that hold our lives together. They try and look at everything from a purely rational perspective. But they're also quite well known for some of their sort of sub-movements, including what I thought's most interesting, probably for your listeners tonight, the effective altruism movement, which you've actually done quite a lot of looking into with the work we do with Flux and a lot of the corporates that we're involved with, because corporations are looking at ways to get more bang for their CSI buck. And I think governments are looking for those sorts of things too. Obviously, we're in quite constrained economic times at the moment, so it doesn't look like things are going to be letting up anytime soon, whether you're into crypto or NFTs or whether you're into good old rands and dollars. It does look like for a lot of us, we're going to have to be tightening our belts. And this, of course, does tend to affect the most vulnerable and the poorest people among our communities in an outsized manner. So the effective altruism movement, which is part of the whole rationalist community, tries to look at ways to actually get a return on essentially charity. So a return on investment with every rand or every dollar or every cent that is actually given to charitable causes, it should be having some sort of a measurable effect in the communities we're trying to uplift. And we know this. I mean, we know the statistics about how so much of the money we donate to the to conventional charities ends up being spent on bureaucracies or on fancy, you know, like few hundred thousand dollar plates dinner parties for the rich and fabulous. And a lot of it gets lost along the way, and not all of it ends up actually fixing things in the communities it's supposed to fix. But what's really fascinating about this effective altruism movement, and Tom does a great bit of going into how the logic plays out, is that the effective altruism movement is effectively kind of branched into two different branches. The one that looks at things from a really big existential crisis point of view, saying the best thing we can do with our spare capital that we want to do good for humanity at large is actually to invest in preventing the existential crises that could end our species. And in particular, the rationalist community has converged on the idea the most rational way to spend your money on the going big stream of effective altruism is actually to invest in preventing the singularity or preventing an evil AI from coming and taking over the world. Some of your listeners might be familiar with Roko's Basilic, and I'm actually friendly with Roko on Twitter. He's quite a character. He's not everybody's cup of tea. But he posed a thought experiment on one of the sort of fringy blog sort of forums on some strange corner of the internet. And it was this blog post that actually got Elon Musk together with his baby mama Grimes, incidentally, if anyone is interested in this. And they debated Roko's Basilic, this whole sort of thought experiment, which is essentially, if an artificially intelligent singularity is going to come into being in the future, and it is a benevolent artificial intelligence, then anyone who prevents that artificial intelligence from achieving its singularity will actually be working against the singleton or this AI singularity, and the AI actually has an incentive to effectively destroy you. And the whole catch with this whole sort of thought experiment is that now that I've told you about it, now you're no longer innocent, and now you've got two choices. You could either work to bring the singularity about, or you can work against it and actually put yourself at risk. So sorry, I've cursed you all.
You've cursed us all, Bronwyn. You've cursed us all. But back, let's get back to tamer stuff. Tom Chivers, who has written The Rationalist Guide to the Galaxy, what are us normal human beings going to extract from this book that is useful to us?
Yeah, so let's get back to that point. So as I was saying, with the rationalist movement and the effective altruism movement, some of them are saying we've got to work to solve really big problems, which tend to be a bit far removed from our day-to-day lives and could actually be seen as a bit of an excuse not to fix the real problems among us, which is the point I was trying to get to. The other stream of the effective altruism movement says that instead of thinking about big lofty goals or about the sort of mid-wit kind of goals that a lot of your current corporate social investment teams and marketing departments like to focus on, you know, the ones that look good on press releases and on blog posts and that sort of thing. But the other thing that we can be doing to get a high return on our spend in terms of CSI investment is actually to look very small at things that have a very quantifiable return on spend. And Julia Galef is probably one of the more sort of prominent people in the space. She has a very well-known podcast called Rationally Speaking, and she's quite a big proponent of this sort of small form of effective altruism. And there's many economists that have also worked in the space and have looked at things and say that we might feel very good about donating to fancy charities that might want to put certain children through certain school programs or whatever, however the press release is put together. But if you actually look at it in terms of return on impact that you get for the rands that we spend, quite often the simplest, smallest interventions can have the biggest impact. Things like putting mosquito nets into hands of people who live in malaria areas. A very low-key thing to do, and it's not a particularly exciting thing to talk about, but it can save lives. And the return that you get on those lives you can send from that very, very small investment is huge. Other things that come up often in these sorts of conversations are things like deworming tablets that gets kids to school more often, or giving money to women instead of to men in communities,
yeah.
Because it's more likely that money is going to end up actually feeding families rather than being spent in other directions. Again, I'm not going to go too far into those sorts of studies, but there are many of them.
Absolutely.
And there are, in fact, quite a lot of award-winning, you know, Nobel Prize-winning economists that have also done research into this whole sphere and saying that quite often the least sexy interventions can have the biggest impact. And if we really do want to have impact, we should be focused on those things that have a tangible, quantifiable, rational return on investment rather than just a return on our sort of on our egos or return on our press releases. And we kind of have to think about what we're really doing there. I think that's a really interesting idea to take away from it. Of course, the book is full of all the more weird and wonderful aspects of the rationalist community, including how they're not particularly rational about all sorts of things, including things like the singularity, because coming back to the other sorts of effective altruists, the one who wants to solve big existential problems, one of the solutions they come up with is actually we should give them, the rationalist community, more money because they're the only ones thinking about these problems. They managed to rationalize themselves into thinking that the most rational thing we can do without social investment is to give it to them.
No,
which is
but
incredible.
If you're a true rationalist, why would you be part of a community of like-minded people? Because surely not everybody is rational. And this is the problem with these sort of big idea, pie in the sky ideas. Is that you just end up with a new version of groupthink, I suppose. But this idea that you can can have huge impact on with micro interventions on local scale rather than trying to change the world. I mean, Bill Gates, I think, does a fair amount of really, really good work on a very macro scale. But for most of us, we can actually achieve very good things in small ways that have very big positive impact on the lives of those closest to us.
A manifold return on our time, on our effort, if we're thinking about that in more rational terms. So, yes, while many things we can laugh about with these sorts of communities when they do get a bit too inward and myopic looking, they also are really tangible lessons that we can take away. And the book is a funny. It's a very funny read. It's exciting. It's full of anecdotes. It makes you laugh, definitely. But it also challenges you to think. So if you sort of push past the more sort of fringy ideas in the space to the practical ones that really are based on rationality, there's a lot we can be doing better if we do think in terms of return, not in terms of ego. And I think that's a really important lesson for anyone in a leadership position, public or private sector, to really be thinking about if we do want to fix things going forward.
Thank you, Bronwyn Williams. She's a trend translator, the future finance specialist at Flux Trends. The book this evening, The Rationalist's Guide to the Galaxy by Tom Shivers, Chivers. And certainly, you know, there's some very highbrow thinking in there. But as Bronwyn says, there's lots of really funny stuff in there as well. And there's these weird and obsessive cultish sort of organizations who, by their very nature, claim not to be what they are. And you can make up your own mind on that one. That is tonight's business book, The Rationalist's Guide to the Galaxy.
702.
SMS Bruce
on 31702.
In case you missed it, a terrible day on markets today. It really has been rough, not only here, but around the world as well. We were down about 2% by the close. And as I have a quick look at what's happening in the United States, where the S&P 500 is off 3%, the Dow is off 2%. European markets lost between 1.5% and nearly 3% on the day. So certainly very, very tough days, which started off in Hong Kong and in Tokyo this morning with 3% losses across those markets. So the good sense today goes to the Australians, and that doesn't often happen. They had a holiday today, so they've avoided this particular route. Overnight trade is going to determine, of course, the direction of tomorrow's markets. But for now, it doesn't look great. The optics are not fabulous, as the rand has lost about 4% of its value against the US dollar today. And we see the gap between the euro and the dollar closing ever more. Interesting times through which we are living. Mkabisi Ntlejana, the Associate Professor of Political Science at UJ, is tonight's Other People's Money guest. We're going to talk about another person's money first, because he is a political analyst after all. And then we'll talk about his own money. That's coming up in a couple of minutes.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. Proud to collaborate with the SA Tomorrow Conference. That's Africanacity. Absa's a registered FSP.
The Money Show.
Other people's money.
Mkabisi Ntlejana, the Associate Professor of Political Science at UJ, with us this evening as political analyst. Before Mkabisi, we talk about your money, there is a guy whose money we need to talk about a little bit first, if you don't mind. And he is, I suppose, a guy who, if reported to be believed, kept a large amount of forex stored in a couch on his farm, and I'm sure in other places as well. And from what I'm told, it's not an uncommon practice amongst the rich and the powerful in South Africa to keep amounts of cash at home. So I don't think it's an isolated incident. But just how much trouble is the president in as we look at sort of day 7 or 8 of this particular saga?
I could hardly hear you there, Bruce, but I think I got your question. But I mean, he's still in a trouble somewhat. Because there are certain things that we don't know and are quite concerning. Two things, actually: whether he had paid tax on that money, whether he had declared it, and possibly a third one of under whose instructions were the thieves tortured. I mean, I've been talking about this for quite some time now, for a few days, actually, and one of the things I've been saying is that I doubt that the president would have instructed people to torture those thieves. But those are concerning three issues, though, that have to be answered. We need questions to that. I'm not really worried about how the money got there. We all know that our president is rich, is in the habit of buying buffaloes for 20 million rand. So it's not entirely surprising that he would have money, but the money would be hidden under mattresses and all that.
The same rules apply to all of us. We're not allowed to keep vast amounts of foreign exchange. I don't even think you're allowed to keep a dollar note at home. If you just read the small print of when you do go and get foreign exchange, it says you take this is for travel purposes only, and then when you come home, then you give it all back again. Unless things have opened up a little bit, you can have foreign exchange accounts attached to your bank account, but it's all stuff that is in the public domain and stuff that is declared, and that is, you know, any authority wants to get information. Cash is just that little bit trickier. Cash is just that little bit smellier. Cash is just that little bit more difficult to explain. And I guess that's why we have a problem here. Is his political career in trouble? Is it over?
No, it's not. It's not. We don't know how long he had all that cash in his house. I'm told he has 30 days or something like that, so within which to declare or deposit it. So one can't quite reach a firm conclusion on that right, because, you know, we simply don't know. As to his career, well, it would depend on the extent of the infraction. assuming that he didn't declare and all that stuff, then that becomes an infraction. It then gets to become a question of extent. Is it something that the ANC feels that they have to fire him for not declaring? And yeah, things like that. So first it must be proven, and then determine the nature of the fine. If it's a fine that they think he should go down for, then I guess that's the ANC to decide. But I wouldn't. We need to keep a certain degree of perspective here, Bruce.
Importance, absolutely.
You don't want to be eating up our presidents almost every year.
Correct, absolutely.
There are certain things that are worth. Yeah,
absolutely. And we've also got to go, you know, from whence it comes as well, in terms of the source of the leak, and the source of the information is in itself politically fraught and quite questionable, if you like, in terms of the way things operate in South Africa. And, you know, if an infraction was done, that's fine. An infraction is an infraction. But let's not put too far in the back of our minds the real big motives here, that there are elements of the ANC who would love to see Cyril Ramaphosa's political career flayed alive.
Yeah, well, that's precisely my point. Avoid getting into some kind of a frenzy, kind of a mob mentality, and allowing people with ill intentions to set the parameters of the debate, to direct us exactly into doing what they want to see happening.
Yeah,
and they want to see instability. That is why they did this.
Unfortunately, the president is playing directly into that narrative by not disclosing. And I'm sure that he's got lawyers working furiously in the background, determined to clear his name on this thing. But, you know, the quicker the information gets out, the better, surely, for everyone.
I think you want accurate information. You don't just want any other piece of information. So, of course, it shouldn't take too long. They should investigate, do everything to make sure that they've uncovered every piece of information. I would be content with that. I mean, I tend to be somewhat flabbergasted by the rush for answers, as if people want any answer. You have to find out the truth, and that requires a bit of time. Of course, we have to be reasonable about that time span. But the idea that answers must be provided immediately, regardless of whether or not they might be thorough, is just nonsense for me, yeah.
Okay, let's talk about you, because that's why we invited you, because we want to find out about you. Tell us where you grew up. Tell us about the vast amounts of cash under your mattress as a small child. Now, where did you grow up? What was life like?
I grew up in P, actually, in Zwide. Born in New Brighton, grew up in Zwide, PE. Life was interesting, you know, township life in Zwide. You do all the kind of things that young folks that do in Zwide, playing soccer, playing cricket, actually, on the streets. We certainly didn't have any stash of cash under mattresses. Every penny counted, and it all had to be budgeted for. Yeah.
What did mum and dad do? What was the family life all about?
I was raised by my grandmother, so okay. I pretty much grew up with my grandmother.
But such a common story, isn't it? I mean, so many kids of, you know, I don't know what age you at all, but yeah, the 80s, 90s. Again, grandparents playing this absolutely pivotal parental role.
Yes, yes. I mean, that's a common story. Extended family mainly. Generally, in black communities, we don't talk of a nuclear family.
No, absolutely.
Aunts, uncles, they're all part of the family, and it gets somewhat interesting that way, because you can rely on a number of people for support and all manner of things. Yeah.
And yes, you can rely as you grow up on support, and then of course later on that sort of responsibility falls upon you, does it not? Because so many future generations of kids unfortunately find themselves in similar situations.
Yes, it does. And that's a family network that has tended to be quite useful, actually, for Black families, because very few of them make it to universities. Well, used to, but now things have changed, but we still have a huge problem even now. But the few that are able to make it to university to get a good job, they then have to make sure that the others follow as well. You have to throw the rope over the wall so that the others on the other side can also climb up.
Yeah.
So that's the family network that is critical, especially for poor families. Yeah.
Who is your role model? Who was sort of driving you to make sure that you went to university? That made sure that you went and got the education that you did get.
My grandmother was a fervent believer in education. She had wanted to go to school. She didn't go beyond standard three. Her father wanted to marry her away to some idiot. And she fled the family home, fled for PE. I mean, she must have been 16, 17 or something like that. You know, even though she never went to or went further beyond standard three, she wanted her kids to go to university. My mother became a nurse. She now has a master's degree, actually, in nursing.
Mm.
And raising me up, my grandmother was always, and she was a very strict woman, you know, she could use that belt, hey, very menacing figure, and all loving and strong authority as well. So she's the one who really made sure that I go to varsity. And I remember when I went to Verts for my first year in 1993, I had a sales house bursary because she had an account with sales house. So I kind of benefited as well from some of the investment that she made with my education in mind. Yeah.
And thank goodness for smart, particularly matriarchs in South Africa, because I think so many people owe so much to matriarchal figures in their families, whether they be mothers, whether they be grandmothers or aunts. I think they've played a huge, huge role. Your first job, what was it? When you left university, once you graduated from WITS?
Well, my first serious job really was an intern, you know, where I got a salary from one Canadian NGO, actually, in Braamfontein. That was an internship, but the very first one, serious one, was at the Center for Policy Studies under Stephen Friedman, who was my director there. We all had a very exciting group of people to work with. Kehla Shubane, Kolela Mango. So it was a nice place to work at as a young researcher. Got a lot of training and exposure. Yeah.
Those jobs don't tend to pay a vast amount of money, but you know, they tend to be sort of like, this, you do it for the experience and we'll make sure you don't starve. And you end up really earning your stripes in the world of research and the world of political science, which you now inhabit.
Well, I mean, that's a decision I had to make. I remember having this discussion with Tom Lodge, who was my supervisor for my PhD. In the 90s, I mean, 90, when I finished my honors, 96, 97, a lot of people were going into government, you know. With an honors degree, you could have a fairly well-paying job. But Tom discouraged a whole lot of us from doing that and instead redirected us into research. And of course, part of ensuring that we stayed in research was to give us jobs at school, money, so that we would not be tempted to leave, right? And so we knew, I mean, one knew from the very beginning that this is not the kind of career path where you make bucket loads of money. You know, it's all about research rather. And and passion. You know, scholarship is all about passion. It's not about money, really. So if you want to make money, then you are into a different career altogether. Or wrong career altogether.
Did you, I mean, do you sometimes sort of lie awake at night worrying about the bills going, damn you, Tom Lodge, I can't believe you did this to me. I could have gone and got a cushy job. I could have become a director general in a government department. I could be sitting pretty. I could be sitting with a government pension. I could be doing, or are you grateful that you've kept your independence? Well, from the little bit I do know about you, I think you're a bit too independent to have gone into government.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I have very strong opinions. I like my space. I want to do exactly what I want to do. Control my own time. Sit down, write, sit at home, write, go to the office if I have to go to the office. You know, so I'm very particular about how I arrange my space. The best thing for me is to have uninterrupted time. That for me, that's the best time because I get to sit and read and write. So, you know, I might not have the money, but I have something that I treasure quite highly. Yeah.
I mean, do you put a particular value on money? None of us wants to be poor. But do you have some people really do lust after money? Again, you can't do your job if you are somebody who wants material wealth.
Well, money, everybody wants money. I mean, I have kids who are always wanting to take Uber and order out Uber Eats, and, you know, holidays have to be had and dinner at some fancy restaurant. So we all want money. But for me, money is the, what I like about it, it is allowing me to do the kind of things that make my life easy. I mean, if I want to go to some fancy restaurant, I can do that easily. Buy as many books as I want. Have an unplanned trip somewhere for some emergency. So it makes life easy, but it's not for me to flash around. You know, it helps to have money because it makes life a lot easier. But it's not something to brag about for me, you know. Flashy clothes, walking around like a peacock.
But if you do have... If you do have a spending desire, is it for books? I mean, do you buy books that you never read, or are you quite picky and fastidious about what it is that you select, or is there stuff on gathering dust on your bedside table?
It's books that I read. Get a fancy Apple gadget now and then. And mainly crying and going out a lot with the family. So, and holidays, yes. I mean, holidays, my wife especially insists on that stuff.
Well, my wife insists on that stuff, and you just go along because, hey, you know, she'd be lonely without you. What sort of holidays? Are these kind of lavish affairs? Are they, do you like going to the bush and going rustic? What do you like?
Going to the bush, mainly. Driving to Mpumalanga, you know, KZN, just these long drives into the bush. Not really hotels. Hotels are not part of a holiday, really. But disappearing somewhere, seeing a new area altogether. My daughter's idea of a holiday is is having room service. So having as much room service as possible.
And that stuff comes with a bill, of course. Do you ever get to switch off? I mean, when you go on holiday, do you switch off, or do you sneakily sort of sit quietly at half past five in the morning before everybody else wakes up and catch up on current affairs and catch up on your social feeds? Do you do that sort of thing, or do you ever defrag completely? And I think so many people struggle to do that, especially as we've got so much access to so much information so much of the time.
I try to switch off, but I always take stuff along with me. So what I would do would be, I would wake up in the morning early, around 6, do some work. My family, are sleepers, you see. So they sleep up until could be 10, 11.
What?
So that would give me a solid 5 or so hours of doing some work. Thereafter, I rejoin the holiday activities, yeah. But I can never switch off completely. I mean, there's always something to do.
Absolutely right. Any bad money habits? Anything that you're sort of embarrassed about? Anything that you'd really rather not tell us about, but you will?
People ask for money, and I tend to give them quite easily. I've never managed to say no to people, especially because people need it. They're always asking. It's 300, 400 in there. Then one realizes that you've given out almost 2,000, 2,500 per month. So I wish I could learn to say no, but it's something I'm still grappling with.
But you can't grow up in the environment that you grew up in and say no, I don't think. I mean, I think it is that much harder, because if anybody had said no to you while you were growing up, you wouldn't have got to where you've got to today. I think that makes it that much more complicated, doesn't it?
I guess that's it. And those demands are a lot higher now with quite a lot of people not working. And you feel bad. You can't say no when you know you have money. You know, it's like you lie. You feel bad, so you end up. Unless, my budget is quite tight, then I would really feel courageous to say no. But if I have extra, I just give.
Yeah, it's tough. We live in a tough environment and things are really hard, and I think people are coming really unstuck, and the obligation on people with means has never been more acute, and I fear it's going to get just a little bit tougher. When you look at your prospects, and Khabisi, you've just had this wonderful promotion now at UJ, do you feel like you've cracked it? Do you have big global ambitions? What's the next move?
I've always wanted to be a full professor, and I have finally gotten there. For now, I'm just content churning out books, teaching. How old am I? I'm turning 49 this December, so I'm not even 50 yet. So for now, it's just writing books. I wouldn't say no. Or rather, I can't say I won't go beyond in terms of administrative position and all that. But for now, I'm kind of happy with where I am. And also, to change career, it's something that you have to want to do and not do it for money. Because, I mean, I've seen these jobs. They are demanding. 24-hour jobs.
Exactly.
You have to give them your all.
Exactly. It's much more fun It's much more fun to poke fun at others. Nkubise Ntletjana, thank you so much. Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Johannesburg. Wonderful to get some insights from you this evening. Other People's Money with Nkubise Ntletjana.